to VBAC Birth Stories, a podcast where Australians share their journey to a vaginal birth after cesarean.
We are a safe haven for women to share their own VBAC journeys and through these personal experiences, educate and empower listeners.
I'm your host, Mel.
And I'm your host, Steph. And this is VBAC Birth Stories.
Hi everyone. In this episode, Steph and I chat to Christy, a mum of two living with her husband and two boys in Brisbane. In Christy's first birth, she was recommended an induction due to obstetric cholestasis. Despite dilating to 10 centimetres, Christy was taken into theatre for an emergency cesarean. She did not know what actually caused her cesarean until years later. After a difficult start to breastfeeding, which involved a tongue tie, Christy was diagnosed 1 year after the birth with post-traumatic stress disorder, and she bravely and honestly shares the forms this took with her and her coping mechanisms to help deal with the psychological trauma inflicted by her first birth. Christy understandably really struggled with the decision on whether or not to book an elective cesarean or go for a VBAC during her second pregnancy. This was compounded by a meeting with an obstetrician who gave her a less than 40% chance of having a successful VBAC, as he suspected that she may have a narrow pelvis. But ultimately, with the support of her husband, her primary midwife from her public hospital's midwifery group practice, and her doula, Christy went on to naturally birth her, quote-unquote, giant second baby, who was 4.75 kilograms or 10 pounds. There's really so much to take away from Christy's story as someone preparing for their birth or as a birthing professional. Christy shares some of the risk factors for birth trauma and developing PTSD, which is really insightful and so important for healthcare workers to hear and understand its implications not only for the mother, but how it can in turn affect her baby as well, and take this away to better their own practice. Thank you, Christy, for sharing your inspirational story with us. We understand this episode can be triggering for some. We've included some support sites and networks in the show notes, and we hope you know that if you are feeling affected by events from your own birth, that you absolutely can reach out for help, just as Christy did. We hope you all enjoy this episode. Hi, everyone. We're with Christy from the lovely Sunshine State. Christy, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So as you said, I'm in the lovely Sunshine State of Queensland. I am a teacher of English and social sciences, and I have two beautiful boys. One's 3.5 and one 6 months now, which is a very interesting age combination, but I still have my sanity. So we got well.
It's a great, great age combination, that one, I think. So did you want to take us to before you fell pregnant with your first, and any ideas that you had about pregnancy or childbirth before you fell pregnant?
I actually, for a very long time, was quite adamant that I wasn't going to be having children. And that changed once I got married. And I think my hormones really kicked in at that point, and they were like, okay, I have a baby now. But I was always kind of just vaguely grossed out by the idea of childbirth, to be honest. But also at the same time, I had this kind of unfailing confidence that it would just somehow magically work because my mother had, quote unquote, successfully delivered 4 children vaginally with no major complications. So just went, oh yeah, my mum did it. So of course it's just going to magically work for me. So when we were pregnant, we kind of did all the right things. You know, we went to the birthing classes, we read the books, you know, we got the development apps and kind of followed along and thought, yep, we've done all the preparation we need. Let's just head off into this birthing adventure together.
And did you have any complications in that pregnancy at all?
I was diagnosed with obstetric cholestasis at 38 weeks, which is a liver disease where your liver can't process salts properly and it starts to store them under your skin. The main symptom of that is actually just like insane itchiness. Just being crazy itchy all the time. So, but otherwise, I was actually really only just over the threshold for the test. So I really wasn't a severe case of it. Now, at that time, the hospital that I was at had a policy where they like to push for an induction because there was some evidence to suggest that there was an increased risk of stillbirth. I've since done more research and it turns out not so much evidence that there's an increased risk of stillbirth, but, you know, at the time that was sort of the evidence that was presented to me that I went with, really.
With this condition, was there any treatment that you could use to sort of alleviate the symptoms during pregnancy? Or
yeah, there was something too that would alleviate the itching, but because I was already full term at 38 weeks, they went, oh, let's just put you in for induction tomorrow and that way we'll bypass any risk of the stillbirth. Yeah.
Did you have any prior knowledge about the induction process or what that would involve?
I had whatever they kind of told us at the birthing class. So I knew that there would be some kind of like suppository or pessary inserted vaginally, and that the process also involved breaking the waters and possibly then syntocin and drip, depending on how you were going. So yeah, I knew the nuts and bolts of it. I wasn't really prepared for the kind of emotional side of the induction process, which was, you know, not ideal, being ill prepared for that. Yeah.
How did you find that? How did you react to that? What came about for you?
Yeah, so I was doing quite well with the process up until the point where they broke my waters. And at that point, and I'm going to get graphic here, but I suppose everybody does.
Mm-hmm. It's a birth story.
All right. At that point, my cervix hadn't softened at all. So it was still, you know, just normal.
High and close.
Non-birth, yeah. High and close cervix. So they had to kind of grab that and yank it, pull it down to an accessible position, you know, and then insert what they call the hook, which is just really nice mental image of that. You know, it was really very painful, really painful. And it was really traumatic. Like I was later diagnosed with PTSD from that moment, among others. So that was, you know, obviously not an ideal start to the birth. And then as soon as they broke my waters, the contractions went from nothing to like back to back, maybe 20 seconds between contractions.
Was that because they turned up the drip?
I didn't actually have any syntocin at all through my labor. It was just like, as soon as they kind of broke the waters, it was just like my body went, oh, okay, labor. And it was like flipping a switch. And that is something else I think that, you know, I really wasn't prepared for. Crazy intense contractions, just back to back, no break or very little break, irregular contractions. I should mention my baby was also posterior at this point, which didn't help because you get, you know, longer labor and the back pain along with the contractions. So yeah, pretty unpleasant labor. Not that any labor is pleasant, I will say. Yeah. So
what were you using as pain relief once this all kicked off?
So I think, I had a pretty bad midwife, I'm not going to lie, and that will come up through the story.
Yes.
She was really pushy right from the get-go that she wanted to give me an epidural, and she was really quite disempowering. She actually said after the water ruptured, she said, oh, I'm a really good judge of character and I'm really good at knowing what people can and can't handle, and I really think you're going to be somebody who benefits from an epidural. We're in for a really long labor and I really think you're going to need it. And I actually had to argue with her multiple times and say no, and it was in my birth plan that I didn't want an epidural. I think I actually did end up agreeing to having an injection of pethidine, more to kind of get her off my back than anything.
Did she read your birth plan?
She did, and she actually kind of queried me on a couple of other things as well and went, oh, you've written this, but I really like to do it this way, so would you be able to kind of, yeah, she was really bad.
Like, just, it's sort of like saying to someone before they start a race, look, you're not going to make it to the finish line, so let's just bail you out now or something. Like, it's pretty, as you said, disempowering, but it doesn't really, instill a lot of confidence in you. And if you have to deal with a difficult personality on top of your physical pain, like, it's really a bit unfair to put that on someone.
Yeah, like I said, she was really not great, and I've been able to kind of recognize that with some time and distance away and acknowledge that. So yes, there we were. I'd had a shot of pethidine, which kind of, like, you know, dulled it a little bit, but not a lot. I had sterile water injections a bit later to help with the back pain, which I did find helpful. And a bit later on in labor, I also started using the gas and air, which was probably more effective in the sense that it helped alleviate my anxiety more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And just keep me a little bit more relaxed about what was going on.
as your labor progressed, like, were you getting updates? Were they doing vaginal examinations to?
Yeah. As my labor progressed, yeah, it actually progressed quite quickly. So in 4 hours from the time they broke my waters, I'd actually dilated 4 centimeters. So I was, you know, going through the textbook dilation, you know, 1 centimeter per hour, which is why they didn't feel the need for syntocinon. Probably the biggest problem with my labor was that they wanted to do the constant fetal monitoring, because that's, you know, standard process with an induction. And the telemetry equipment, the mobile telemetry stuff, you know, the stuff they stick on your belly to monitor the heart rate, kept falling off every time I moved. So I had this pretty terrible midwife who was, you know, I know they have a hard job, but she was pretty terrible. And she wanted me in the bed on my back so she could keep the monitoring equipment strapped to my belly. And I knew we'd done enough reading that I was like, oh, I think I really should be moving. But I wasn't really in a mental state to kind of push back and go, no, I'm going to get up and move around now. You know, I was a first-time mum thinking, oh, they know best. I'll just do as told. So I really spent, you know, the vast majority of my labor in bed on my back, which obviously really didn't help with a posterior baby who needed to turn and get into the right position for labor, really, and for birth.
Did your midwife know baby was posterior?
No.
Okay.
No one had actually told us that. The only reason I knew was talking about it later on and the back pain that I had and the problems we had with birth, I realized later, oh, okay, he was posterior. That explains a few things.
What went on from there?
We got to a point where baby had started to descend and we had a midwife changeover. So this was probably about 8 a.m. in the morning, and I'd been in labor for nearly 12 hours at that point. And the midwife who changed over, she was really excellent. But by that point, it was kind of too late. So baby's head was deflexed at this point, which I didn't know. And nobody had told me in an examination that that's what position, that was the position baby was in. So I got to the point where I was pushing, and I was pushing for hour and a half. And baby never got to crowning. So baby was about maybe an inch away from crowning, and I could see baby's head in the mirror, and pushed and pushed and pushed, and nothing happened. I do remember saying, you know, oh, I need help at some point, which to be fair, probably everybody says when you get to the pushing point. And it was quite a wait for the doctor to come. Like, the midwife had to go out and kind of hurry the doctor along. And he got in and said, you know, the head deflexed, it's swollen at this point, it's not safe for me to go in with, I can't get in with the forceps, so at this point I think the safest option is going to be a cesarean. And I kind of held it pretty together at that point, but as soon as he mentioned, you know, we were going to have an emergency cesarean, it was just this massive trigger of, oh my God, I failed. And yeah, it was really just kind of this overwhelming sense of failure of that, and that inherent belief that, oh yeah, I'll be able to give birth to my baby, was just, you know, obviously really challenged in that instant. And I remember turning to my husband and went, I'm sorry, I can't do this. And of course he lost it, because at this point he's exhausted. And
did they comment that you were fully dilated, did you say?
Yes, I did reach fully dilated. Yeah, like I did get there.
Yeah.
Was there any other option presented to you, or it was just sort of, you know, the only option here is to go in for an emergency cesarean? There was no talk of, let's give a little bit more time for his deflexed head to look down? Or
no one even told me it was deflexed at that point, actually. Like, Dr. Okay. Kahn, it was later.
Yes. When
I was, because you're very, very vulnerable to the suggestion that, you know what, I can stop this pain and all this hard work, and I can just, you know, I'm going to be able to make it go away and fix all your fears right now if we just go and, yeah. So no other option was really given. We didn't know enough. We didn't feel confident enough to push back for another option. So we elected for the emergency cesarean at that point.
Was baby's heart rate going okay at this point? It was just the head stuck, yeah, sort of, yeah, that position.
Yeah. But yeah, he was at no point in fetal distress.
When you had made that decision to go into theatre, did you have any sort of preconceptions about what cesareans involved, or any ideas in your mind? Like you said before there that you felt like a failure. What had that stemmed from? What had given you that notion?
I really think, and this isn't taking anything away from my mum, but she'd always been so proud of the fact that she'd given birth to four children vaginally without any kind of intervention. And I guess because I heard that from a very early age, that was kind of like, well, that's what birth is. It's the only thing that birth is. I had a pretty narrow definition of it. And even when they were talking about, you know, emergencies, cesareans and complications in the classes, I can remember going, oh, that won't happen to me. Mm-hmm. You know, that old... Just,
yeah, it's, you know, it's sort of presented as such a rare occurrence that you think there's no way that'll happen to us, really. Yeah, that won't really be us.
Like, you know, we're doing all the classes, like we're, you know, we're doing our homework. Of course things aren't going to happen outside of our control.
Yeah, that's right.
You want to tell us about how the cesarean went?
Yep, so it was fairly textbook cesarean. I don't remember because at this point I think I was a bit in shock, as everyone probably is in that position. My husband remembers him saying that, you know, he was really quite stuck. They had to exert quite a bit of force from, you know, above to actually pull him back through the birth canal and through the opening. I do remember, you know, when they put him on my chest and expecting that, you know, the wave of love and protectiveness, and all I kind of felt was just this really a sheer sense of relief, like, you know, thank God it's over. Oh my God, now I have this tiny human to try and keep alive, but I'm in such a state of, well, you know, I was in a state of trauma. I just didn't realize it at the time. So I was, you know, that kind of fed into my feelings of failure later on, of not feeling that love and that bond with my baby from the very beginning. But the cesarean went, you know, well, they didn't have to go in with any other incisions, so they just stitched me up. Something I'm still quite angry about is that when they finished, they sent my husband with the baby out of the room, and I was supposed to follow pretty much immediately after. They didn't actually have a bed ready for me to take me to recovery, so I was sitting in the operating room while they were, you know, people were just cleaning up around me for about 20 to 30 minutes separated from my baby. And no one spoke to me. No one came to reassure me that a bed was coming or that my baby was doing okay. I was just lying there in this state of total shock. And I now understand that that's a really massive risk factor in something becoming a traumatic experience, is when you're left alone. So, you know, I have a fair bit of anger about that. Like, I know, you know, obviously the hospital did what they could, but if I had my time again, I would have known to say, No, they're going to stay until I'm in the bed and being wheeled out of the room.
So what happened then? Did you go into recovery from there, and physically were you feeling any effects after the surgery?
So I went into recovery. I didn't feel anything sort of for the first sort of few hours. I think, you know, the epidural took a while to wear off. I remember we went into recovery and the midwife grabbed the baby and just put him straight onto my nipple and to try and, you know, establish that feeding, which I now know is, again, not ideal. And
did you find that forceful?
I did, yeah, because there was, she didn't actually tell me what she was doing. She literally grabbed my breast, shoved baby on, and then he latched, and he ended up actually having a tongue tie, which was a whole other thing. So it was like painful, uncomfortable. I have big boobs as well, so I was like, this doesn't feel right, and wasn't nice. Like, I didn't get off to a good start feeding my baby, for sure.
So did you have pain feeding at the start because of the tongue tie?
It's like, yeah, instantly, like just this really pinchy kind of, yeah, pinchy painful sensation on that. I was really, really really passionate about breastfeeding. So we actually did manage to get my milk to come in on day 7. And that was with a lot of, you know, massage, pumping, trying to feed. Well, we also got the tongue tie resolved to sort of, you know, help the latch become a proper latch.
So what happened from there in terms of your feeding journey?
Look, the feeding journey was a bit of a mixed journey. When we got his tongue tie separated, we kind of went to the closest clinic. Like, we didn't do a lot of research. It was just kind of, right, let's get this fixed so that, you know, we can just move on to feeding. Later on down the track, it turns out that they didn't do a total separation. So I did have sort of persistent feeding issues in terms of nipple pain, baby swallowing too much gas, baby being very unsettled because he always had a belly full of gas, baby couldn't burp properly, which I didn't realize was related to tongue tie, but apparently is physiologically. So he went and got his tongue tie re-released, this time by laser, when he was 10 months old, which kind of made a big difference in terms of feeding. So we were able to continue that journey.
Okay, just going back to your hospital stay, you were in recovery. How was the rest of that experience for you?
Let's see. So we were there for a while and then actually got moved to the ward. I know we had a lot of trouble getting our possessions back as well because they took them from the labor room and locked them in a locker. So we couldn't actually get in touch with our families. So our poor families are sitting at home hours after baby's born, like worrying what's gone wrong and not wanting to call because you don't do that when people are in labor. And we eventually got our phones and were able to contact people. I had other issues in that no one offered me any pain relief, and it was actually the next day when I got up and went to go to the breastfeeding class. You know, they encourage you to go to the breastfeeding class. And I was like, well, breastfeeding doesn't feel great, so I'll go to the class. And I was sitting there and I was just like, just this, you know, wave of just agonizing pain hit me and I nearly passed out. And then they were, oh, here's some Panadol, here's some Endone. And I was like, probably.
You were like, Panadol won't cut it. pass me the Endone, please.
Yeah. But that was the first time I'd been offered kind of pain relief after the surgery. And the postnatal care was also, again, not great. I had to remind them when I was due my pain medication. So I had to keep track of it myself and ask for it. Like I had a, you know, the IV antibiotic drip going, and that was like beeping for a refill for about 3 hours, I think, before someone came and filled it. So, you know, my overall impression of the hospital was incredibly under-resourced, which isn't the fault of the staff there, but they just had too many patients really to actually provide a level of care that would, you know, prevent trauma and ensure the best start to the mother baby bond and parenting journey, I guess.
So Christy, what of the caller status, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, did they check over baby, like did they have to do any extra checks?
They must have done when I got diagnosed. They must have done a scan. I can't remember it, but thinking back, they must have done one just to check. No, I think they would have just checked the heart rate actually, and because the heart rate was fine. I did ask about, oh, can we just do, you know, kind of daily scans up until I go into labor to check that baby's okay? And they said, well, it's not really an accurate kind of system. Like babies can seem okay and then encounter stillbirth anyway. So yeah, I kind of did suggest maybe we could monitor, and they kind of went, yeah, that's pretty ineffective.
And then were they looking at you in that sense? Like, did they monitor you after that?
They did, yeah. Well, the itching went away pretty much straight away, actually. So they ended up not even testing me again. They went, oh, you know, we're fairly confident that it's gone. If you do have the itching come back, you know, we'll test you. But otherwise, we're pretty confident that it's been taken care of.
How long did you then stay on the ward for after the birth?
So I gave birth Friday morning. They wanted us to leave on Sunday and I was like, I'm not ready to go home.
That's quite soon after surgery.
They were really, really too busy for the resources that they had available to them. So they wanted us to go home Sunday and I said, no, no, thank you. So we stayed until Monday, and Monday things kind of really came to a head for me mental health wise. I'd kind of pretty much held it together until that point. And then, you know, the baby blues really hit that 3 days after. And that was when we found out he had a tongue tie and my milk hadn't come in. And by that point I was like, okay, this place isn't safe. You all stuck. I'm going home. I don't trust you. I never want to step foot in this hospital again. We're going.
When you were talking about there, sort of the baby blues set in, you know how we talk about traditionally, you know, 2 to 3 days after birth, when your milk comes in, you will usually start crying and have this episode of the baby blues. Yeah. For you, did you know that this was different to that standard feeling that you knew a lot of mothers had after birth?
No, and I really didn't. And, you know, the baby blues for me, like that really severe like uncontrollable crying, really severe depression, probably bordering on psychosis actually, lasted for a couple of weeks. And I had a lot of hypervigilance and inability to sleep, even though I was horrifically sleep deprived, all of which are very classic signs of birth trauma, which nobody picked up. And I just thought were normal. I was like, oh, this is what every new mother goes through. Wow, this is awful.
When you were talking there about borderline psychosis, were you having night sweats or waking up in the middle of the night, quite startled or anything like that?
Yeah, I was having panic attacks at the thought of even going to sleep. I actually just couldn't get to sleep. So that went on for a few days. And I actually believe I was probably borderline psychosis when my mother actually just gave me a sleeping tablet out of her thing and went, I know, you know, you're worried about breastfeeding. Your milk's not in. We're formula feeding anyway. Just please take this so you can get some sleep and we don't have to call the ambulance and get you taken back to to a mental health hospital. So I think it probably could have gone quite differently had she not been there to offer that kind of advice based on her own experience with anxiety and sleeping problems, insomnia and so forth.
It obviously makes it a lot more difficult when you're not getting the basic sleep required to function, but then as a starting point, the anxiety kicks it off and it's a little bit of a vicious cycle.
You know how you mentioned you had PTSD. When did that all sort of come to your realization? Did you have checkups at all? I don't know, was there a 6-week checkup, for example? Was there anything afterwards that, you know, led you to check this out further, the way you were feeling?
We had a couple of midwife visits at home and, you know, they were happy that we'd gotten the breastfeeding happening. And, you know, at that point I was still under the impression that what I was going through mentally was just the normal, I've just become a new parent. Of course I'm shell-shocked and dazed and confused and sleepless and so forth. It wasn't actually until a year later when I was still having flashbacks and nightmares, like recurring nightmares and the night sweats, that I went, oh, maybe this isn't normal. So at that point I went to my GP and she sort of queried PTSD and sent me off to a psychologist for assessment and treatment. So yes, I would say that the checkups were not great in picking up on that.
Yeah, it is a difficult thing, as you said there, because the first year is so intense, but it's certainly very brave after a year to be able to reflect and say, okay, this is out now outside of the norm and we'd actually like to do something about it or seek help. So when you did seek help, did you find your GP useful and not particularly, or I'm just looking at your face. No.
My GP had been fairly dismissive of the whole experience up to that point.
Okay. That's interesting that you say that. Yeah.
Well, for instance, I can remember seeing her for the 2-week check. No, it was even before that. It was the 1-week check. And I told her that I was taking endone for my pain. And she said, oh, you don't need that. People go through cesareans every day. Endone's not a good drug. Just switched to Panadol Nurofen, which I did. Yeah, it felt very much like, oh, here's a referral to the psychologist, off you pop, very much, you know.
Right, yeah. And did you feel like in terms of debriefing from the hospital, did they go over the birth with you at all? Obviously not, by the sounds of it.
Not in a lot of detail. And, of course, they do the whole, do you have any questions about what happened? But they did that within 24 hours of the birth. So, you know, I was still pretty groggy, still very shell-shocked. I actually ended up requesting my notes. Yeah, I think it was that a year later. I went, I actually don't know why we had a C-section. I actually really do not understand why that was our only option. And I would talk about it with my husband, and my memory of what went on when the C-section was suggested was not what actually happened according to his memory, which is pretty common with trauma. And also I think just being in labor and, you know, you're a bit out of it really, let's be honest.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting that what I remembered wasn't actually what happened. So I did need to go back and review those notes, which were pretty sketchy anyway, because, you know, it was just, you know, labor failure to progress. It was only through talking with my husband and then reading the notes that I got the idea. Oh, okay. So his head was deflexed and it was in a not a good position and that's why we ended up having it.
You mentioned there about, you know, the notes saying failure to progress. When you read your hospital notes and you saw the words there, failure to progress, did that affect you in any way, seeing that in your hospital notes?
I definitely did. I mean, I was already dealing with this core belief that I was a failure as a mother and a woman for needing an emergency cesarean. And it kind of really did reaffirm that from a medical perspective, at the very least, my body was a failure, even though that's not how they intended it. The words were damaging, yes.
Where did you go from there in terms of unpacking the birth? So you went back over your notes. What else did you do to return to the birth, and what helped you at that time?
It was really actually quite a long time before I addressed the birth itself in therapy. Like, I started seeing my psychologist, and we just kind of started out with, you know, traditional talking therapy, a little bit of cognitive therapy. And I really just started building kind of an emotional toolkit to just be able to start to approach problems, you know, things like self-empathy as a skill that I'd never practiced before, things like identifying my perfectionistic tendencies, which were feeding into the core beliefs of failure and so on. And it was really self-compassion as a strategy that I found to be the most useful for processing. And I guess I never went through any therapy in the terms of actually talking through the experience, because my flashbacks were making me relive it anyway. But I did find that the self-compassion helped to process them when I was having flashbacks.
So what kind of flashbacks were you having to the birth?
Flashbacks kind of play like, well, you're probably familiar, but they play like a movie in your head. So for me, the movie was lying flat on my back, and I was looking at myself from above, and I was pinned to the bed while they were breaking my waters. Even though that's not what happened, that's what went on in the movie in my mind. And then I'd kind of like zoom forward to lying in the operating theater alone, not having my baby on me. And then I'd kind of fast forward again to the moment when I first gave my baby a bottle and realized that he'd not been getting anything from my breasts for the first 3 days of life, and he was starving hungry. And sort of those kind of three moving images would just play on a loop just for hours and keep me awake.
That's quite difficult.
I found the self-compassion to be the thing that worked for me. So I read a couple of books by Kristen Neff, who specializes in this idea of self-compassion, and she provides some really concrete steps. So the first thing is, like, you know, you acknowledge the pain that you're in and kind of apologize to yourself for it, and go, oh, you know, okay, this is really painful for you. I'm really sorry you're going through this. And then you kind of acknowledge it as a common human experience. Like, oh, everybody, you know, has trouble sometimes. And then you finish with a, you won't feel this way forever, in a very brief nutshell. And I'd sort of kind of developed this mantra that I'd repeat to myself when I was having those flashbacks. And yeah, it did actually help my brain to kind of reprocess them and put the memory where it's supposed to go. Because that's what trauma is, right? It's the memory not being stored in the appropriate place in your brain, essentially.
Were you able to reimagine some of those scenarios, you know, reshape them in any shape and form? In terms of there, you were just talking about the moment where your waters were broken on the bed. You had perceived this memory as being pinned down, even though that wasn't what happened in reality. How did you reframe that particular memory?
Like, to be honest, I probably still have a bit of processing to do around my first birth. I don't know that I have completely reframed it so much as just gotten away from having the flashbacks. I remember I did make a really conscious decision that I was going to reframe my thinking in the sense of, wow, this was really hard for me, and I was so strong. Because, you know, I came out and I mothered my baby and I worked until my milk came in, and I, you know, I parented for the first year in this state of hypervigilance, like, you know, and I really worked quite hard to change the narrative from I'm a victim to I'm really strong because I overcame this. And, you know, it doesn't always work, you know, we like anything with perfectionism or those core beliefs we hold about ourselves. I have bad days where, you know, I can't believe anything, but, you know, I'm a bad mother and so on.
It's always a work in progress.
Yeah. Did you provide any feedback at all to the hospital, in particular the midwife who you had a disconnect with?
Interestingly, I think I must have written that letter in my head at least 50 times. I never actually did. I think that every time I kind of sat down to do it, you know, I'd have the panic attack and I'd be like, I don't have time for this. I've got a baby who's, you know, needing to be cared for and I don't want to relive this experience and feel this way. By the time I got to a point where I felt like I could, I really felt like too much time had passed for it to be a meaningful complaint to the hospital, which may or may not be true. I regret not having, you know, really kind of prioritized putting that complaint in, because I feel like if they had have taken it seriously, possibly actions might have been taken to prevent somebody else from going through that same experience with that same midwife. But, you know, you do what you can.
Absolutely. Well, before we didn't talk about what the hospital actually said, did they give you any indication about future pregnancies and whether VBAC is suitable for you? Was that conversation ever had?
Yeah, I do remember before we left, the doctor came and said, wait 12 months before you get pregnant again, I think is the amount of time they suggest. And there should be no reason why you couldn't have a vaginal birth in the future, was what they told me. And, oh, very good. On my way. Which was, yeah, that was a little bit challenged when I went back to actually ask for a VBAC for my second child. But I guess we'll
take
get to
us
that.
To there. Did you, before you fell pregnant a second time, did you have any feelings of, oh, I don't know if I really want to go through this again, or I don't know if I want to have a second child? Where was your mind at in terms of that decision?
It took me a couple of years to kind of get to the point where I was like, okay, I think we could have another child. I think I'm okay enough with what happened. I know that, you know, when it does come to the point of being pregnant, I'm going to need to. At this point, I wasn't in therapy, so I knew that I was going to have to go back to therapy, you know, pretty much as soon as we were pregnant, which is what I then did. So we fell pregnant very quickly after we decided that we were going to have another child. And I think it was in my first appointment with the doctor that I said, and I'll take a referral to a psychologist as well. Thank you.
That's good. I mean, it's great that you kind of had that self-reflection, that ability to know that's what I need right now, and I'm going to seek that kind of help.
Did you choose to go to the same hospital, or was it a local hospital?
Yeah, there's a story behind that. I am denied about it because, you know, the hospital we had gone to was the closest, and it has, because I live in Brisbane, so metro area, multiple hospitals available. And I knew that hospitals don't like to accept you out of catchment. So I was still kind of umming and ahhing about it. But fairly early on in pregnancy, I actually thought I was having a miscarriage. And so I went back to the hospital where I had given birth to my first child. And I had a really severe panic attack before I even set foot in the door. And it probably wasn't helped by the fact that, you know, I was worried about potentially having a miscarriage. But that panic attack pretty much continued when we, you know, got to the assessment facility waiting for the results and so on. And that was the point when I decided that I wouldn't be returning to that hospital. So I did get a referral to a different hospital just to make it a little bit easier on myself mentally, I guess.
So do you want to take us now, Christy, to, your pregnancy and how you were feeling as you started attending hospital appointments?
Yeah, physically it was actually quite a textbook pregnancy and I didn't get cholestasis again. Yeah, look, my anxiety was a really significant problem during that pregnancy, and that obviously just increased the closer I got to giving birth. I think the way I really dealt with that was just to be quite preemptive and control the situation as much as I could. So we went back and we looked at the first time around and we acknowledged that there were more things we could do to prepare for birth. And those things included having an advocate, essentially. So the first thing I did was I really harassed the hospital, and I mean harassed, to get into the group midwifery program because I really wanted that continuity of care. I wanted to have a team of midwives that knew my story, that knew my preferences. You know, I didn't want luck of the draw again because I hadn't been very lucky the first time around. The other thing we decided to do, probably at about 6 months in, was hire a doula. Now, to do that, we had to decide whether we were going to have an elective cesarean or a VBAC. And that was a really, really hard decision that, you know, I ummed and ahed about for a really long time. And part of that was that the obstetrician at the new hospital, who was quite lovely, told me that because I had been fully dilated with the previous labour, that the head had still gotten stuck, that my pelvis was too narrow to give birth vaginally, which I understand is a very common story that women hear. And so, you know, they threw all the statistics at me of uterine rupture and need for a second emergency cesarean. And he punched all my details into a calculator and said, according to these factors, you have a 40% success rate for a VBAC. And I actually think it's probably a bit lower than that. So that was obviously, yeah, I was pretty devastated to hear that, because up until that point, I'd been quite pro VBAC, this is what we're doing. And that really threw a spanner in the works and made me really question everything and agonize over the decision. And I got to a point where I went, okay, I have this decision to make. I don't want to make this decision based in fear. And I had to really give myself permission to have the elective cesarean without feeling like a failure, or, you know, that I was taking the easy way out. Although anyone who says a cesarean is the easy way out needs a readjustment in their way.
Need some schooling, we have to say.
Really need to recondition a few things in society.
Because, yeah, cesareans are not fun, and the three-month minimum recovery from them is not fun. So, yeah, I really had to actually get to a place where I accepted that I was okay if I had an elective cesarean. It didn't make me a failure. It didn't make me a wuss, or, you know, somebody who was too scared. And it was when I actually really gave myself that permission and kind of leaned into that idea that I went, okay, I can now accept that I would be doing that out of fear, and I don't want to make this decision based in fear. I don't want to go, you know, I'm too scared to do it, so I won't. So we went, okay, we're going to try a VBAC. And we hired a doula, which was probably quite necessary for us, because we just had an extra person with, you know, 30 years of expertise to call on. And I did call her. I called her and texted her a lot after every appointment that I had. I was like, oh, they're saying this. Are you sure I'm going to be able to do a VBAC? And she'd reassure me and say, there's no reason why you can't, you know, deliver this baby vaginally. And she was really, really important for counteracting my anxiety, for sure. And we had to decide from a financial perspective, because once you hire a doula, you then have to pay them, even if you elect to have a cesarean later on, or have an emergency cesarean, really. So we were lucky in that we were positioned to afford a doula, but I wasn't keen on kind of, you know, flushing that much money down the drain. I was also really lucky in that I did get into the group midwifery program, although I really did have to harass them because it's in high demand. And I was given a primary midwife who was and is just absolutely the most amazing midwife I probably could have had, in that she's very, very pro VBAC and very calm. And she would actually advocate and go and not fight against the obstetricians, but I knew that she was really on my side when it came to having a VBAC. And she was the one who actually, for the first time, really made me understand what had gone on in my first labour with the deflexed head. And the fact that I hadn't been moving was actually what led to the emergency cesarean for my first baby. The fact that I'd been lying in my bed with a posterior baby who didn't have an engaged head at the start of labour, it was those factors that led to the emergency C-section, not the fact that my pelvis was too narrow or, you know, I'm biologically incapable of vaginal birth. So she was really excellent, which obviously helped a lot in the lead up, I will say.
Were you ever at any point worried yourself about, you know, your pelvis being too small since the obstetrician planted that seed? Was that something that stuck in your mind, or...?
It definitely was, especially because I went in for a scan at must have been about 7 or 8 months. You know, I'd been worried about baby's movement, and he was fine, but they did follow up with a scan. And during that scan, he was measuring at like the 90th percentile for size. And when babies start to measure as a large baby, they really don't want you to have a vaginal birth, particularly if it's a VBAC. So I was called back into the obstetrician's office twice, actually, to hear all the risks again. And, oh, yes, we see you're electing for a VBAC. They never said we recommend a cesarean. But, you know, they can privilege certain information like the statistics and, you know, they can say things like, well, baby's head got stuck last time and this baby seems a great deal bigger, and then leave you to draw your own conclusions. So they can really push for an elective cesarean without actually saying anything that they're not allowed to say.
With the language that they use.
Would you say that there was bias information sharing at that stage?
There definitely was. And I actually had to really give myself permission to challenge the things the obstetrician was saying. And I can remember one point when I said, okay, yes, I see what you're saying with the risks, but there are benefits to vaginal birth. And he said, what benefits? And I was like, really? Really? You are male who's never going to give birth in any capacity. You're questioning me on the benefits of a vaginal birth. And I said, I pulled out my little scientific data and said, well, you know, it promotes an easier mother-infant bond, and baby gets exposed to certain flora in the mother's vaginal tract, which benefits their, you know, their gut in the first 3 months of life. And like, you know, I tried to pull my stats out.
Also, it's interesting, Christy, because he would have known that information. So surely he was trying to intimidate you in some way.
Well, the second meeting I had, it was actually the third meeting overall, there was him in the room. There was a different midwife who wasn't my primary midwife, the one who bats for me, and there was a medical student. And I really believe they had that many people in the room to pressure me into agreeing to And even though I knew that, you know, I still felt the pressure, and I still felt really awful about, you know, signing the form that says, yes, I acknowledge the risk of the VBAC, and, you know, it's my own fault if my baby dies.
They made you sign a form, a consent form to VBAC?
Yes.
Was it?
Oh, okay. Sign a form. Yeah. Basically saying that they'd explained the risks of VBAC to me in this instance, and, yeah, I took responsibility for the decision, essentially.
Oh, wow.
I got out of that appointment and, you know, sort of cried the whole way home. And bless my little 3-year-old son is in the back going, oh, why are you crying, mummy? And mummy's going, oh, I just felt a bit scared. Oh, going, oh, you're okay, mummy. I'll keep you safe. Bless him.
Oh, beautiful.
So sweet. He's really Christy, was there pressure after that meeting to induce as you neared the end of the pregnancy?
There wasn't. I didn't have any more meetings with the obstetrician. And as I said, my midwife was excellent. So all the appointments with her, she would say, the doctor would like me to mention that induction is an option. And the doctor would like me to mention that stretch and sweep is an option. I'm just giving you all the information so you can decide what to do with it. Like,
great. I wanted to take you back to, you know, the reason for your induction was cholestasis. Am I saying it right?
Well, obstetric cholestasis, but maybe
cholestasis.
I've always heard it cholestasis.
Then it's cholestasis because I don't know what I'm talking about. So did you have any fears actually during your second pregnancy that you would get this again? And is there any way to prevent it? I'm just curious for any mothers out there who had a cesarean similar to yours, after an induction for this particular reason,
I was fairly paranoid about getting it again, to the point where I think I actually ended up getting tested because I was really itchy. And the thing is, you know, once you think you're itchy, then of course you're itchy. So the test came back negative. But I was really relieved when I found out that this particular hospital didn't recommend induction for obstetric cholestasis anyway. So that really helped to alleviate my fears. Because as it turns out, there really is no good evidence that, you know, an obstetric cholestasis baby has a heightened risk of stillborn unless it's severe cholestasis. Like your levels have to be at a certain amount before there is actually a risk to baby, is what the newest evidence suggests. So yeah, I was worried about it up until the point I realized that, oh wait, they're not going to want to induce me over this. Okay, cool. We're good.
That's interesting.
Different hospitals, different policies.
I wanted to ask you, you know, when you had made the decision that you were going to VBAC, did you do anything at that point to prepare yourself, like anything extra when you had made that choice? Or I know you hired a doula, but was there anything in addition to that, that you did, anything physical or mentally to prepare for the VBAC?
I started working with an acupuncturist, which, you know, I know there's no evidence for, and I didn't go to the spinning babies workshop, but I started doing the exercises and all of the position to help, you know, get baby into an optimum position for birth. I was like, well, I'll just do all the things that I can to see if this will work. I'll do everything in my power, and I still have to acknowledge that I don't have total control, but these are the things I do have control over, so that's what I'm going to focus on.
That's a really good mindset to have.
Yeah, did that make you feel good in the sense that, you know, whatever the birth outcome this time around, I've ticked every box that I can.
It really did. And it was empowering as well to look at it and go, okay, well, there are things that I can control and I am really working my hardest to make this work. You know, I am really educated now about the risks of induction much more than I was the first time around. My husband's much more aware. You know, we've surrounded ourselves with people who we trust, which also makes a big difference. So I felt we were in a good position. I'm going to be honest. I was really walking into that birth going, this is absolutely going to end in an emergency cesarean, but at least I'll know I tried. I had zero faith at that point that I was going to successfully VBAC this baby.
The other question we normally ask is about the uterine rupture statistics. And did you have to process that, or were you quite comfortable with the low, it's such a low risk, feeling okay with it? Like, how did you process that? Did that play on your mind?
Look, you know, the idea of uterine rupture is really scary, but I did decide it was quite a low risk and I would mitigate it through constant fetal monitoring during the labor of my VBAC baby. I didn't love the idea of constant fetal monitoring, but I decided that way I wouldn't have to be anxious about that happening and somehow not knowing, even though from what I can understand, it's pretty agonizing and pretty obvious when it does occur.
Yeah. And with the constant fetal monitoring, like you don't have to be on your back for that. You know, is this the one that, like, did your midwife have a chat to you and say, well, this, you know, you can move around, you can be active while this fetal monitoring is attached to you?
Indeed, yes.
Good. Okay. Do you want to tell us the birth story?
So as I got closer to my due date, I was, you know, pretty anxious for things to happen. I knew he was measuring as quite a big baby and I was like, I need him out so he can stop growing. I think I made it to 39 weeks and 5 days, and then I booked myself in for a stretch and sweep like the following week, so I would have been at 40 weeks but not yet at 42 weeks. And it was like, you know, doing that kind of went to my body, hey, she's pretty serious about getting this baby out. So I actually went into labor on my due date, which is, you know, 2% or something of all babies. So the spontaneous labor, it started like, well, pre-labor I should say, started about 2 a.m and it is funny how it is really distinguished from, you know, those warm-up Braxton Hicks contractions. But I was like, oh, okay, this is it. Because, of course, I had never been through spontaneous labour or early labour before, so I didn't really know what to expect. It turns out that my baby, despite all of my hard work, was in posterior position again. Thanks for that, baby. So pre-labour, for the first kind of 10 to 12 hours, was, you know, it was normal. Just, you know, have a contraction, have a lie down, read a book, have a contraction, just, you know, just chill really. And then I was still in pre-labor, but the contractions started getting really quite intense. I was like, oh, okay, that's actually going to need to make some noise here. So we called the doula and we went to the hospital. Even though we knew we were in pre-labor, I felt that like things were so intense that I didn't really believe that we were in pre-labor, even though the contractions were irregular. I was like, no, I'm pretty sure this feels like This feels like real labour to me. And so we got into the hospital about 5 p.m. and luckily my primary midwife was on call and was available. So we had her from the start of our labour, which, you know, immediately set the right tone because I felt very safe and I really trusted her to follow my birth plan and so on. And the pre-labour probably lasted for another 3 hours. And again, didn't feel a lot like pre-labour. So I didn't actually reach active labour until sort of 7 or 8 p.m. that night. And that was when my waters ruptured, or my membranes ruptured spontaneously. And look, I'm going to be honest, it was a very painful, what felt like a very long labour because he was posterior and he was a big baby.
How did the contractions that you were having in this labour compare to your contractions from the first birth?
There was actually a break between them, which was nice. Whereas the first birth, they had been quite, they were back to back the whole time. This one, there was, you know, the gradual progression and I did have a break between contractions. The contractions themselves were more painful, which I didn't think was actually possible. I was like, there is no way that this is going to be more painful than the first time around. Ha ha. But the good thing was, you know, my midwife never once offered me an epidural and I got to transition and I think I was literally screaming for an epidural and everyone just went, oh, you're doing really well. You're doing great. And just, you know, kind of ignored that, which is, you know, one of the reasons why I think it is so important to have someone that knows you. Because my midwife did say to me afterward, when I thanked her for not giving me an epidural, she said, I knew that you didn't want an epidural. So we just, you know, and I was really glad that my husband as well isn't the kind to go, she's demanding an epidural, give her one.
Did you use any other modes of pain relief in this labour?
Just the gas and air in this labour. I was really, really mobile. Like, I don't think I got on the bed for one, maybe two checks the whole time. And the rest of the time I was walking, I was doing squats, I was bending over the bed and lifting my knees, all of which my body was telling me to do to help get this baby into the correct position for birth. And my midwife said to me later, she said, it was just amazing. You know, you were just doing these strange positions and these strange movements that we weren't telling you to do. You were just following what your body was urging you to do. And that was obviously such a big difference to what I had experienced in the first labor. And again, it made me really grateful that I hadn't elected for an epidural because, you know, I wouldn't have been doing any of that. And to be honest, I would have ended up with an emergency cesarean had I elected to have an epidural. I'm not saying that's how it will work for everyone, but for my lovely stubborn posterior babies, that's how it works for me. So we got to active labour, which was yay, exciting. I had a really long, and this is midwife's word, not mine, really long transition, which is again very fun. And probably the worst moment in the whole labour was when I was during transition and the baby was far enough down that the monitoring equipment wasn't picking up baby's heart rate anymore. And once you elect for constant fetal monitoring, they do actually like to have constant fetal monitoring. So I needed to get on my back so they could attach a clip to baby's scalp. And I had warned them that I'd been on my back for the first labor and this was likely to induce a panic attack. And it did. I did have a panic attack during that time. And my midwife did an amazing job. I think she must have said, you're safe, about 50 times while she was doing that procedure, which made the difference in it being a flashback rather than another traumatic experience. So even though I was having a flashback and it was awful at the time, I don't consider that to be a trauma. I haven't processed that as a trauma. Which is
so your midwife was able to talk you down from the panic attack,
yeah,
and able to get you back on the right track while that was occurring.
Yeah, she was, which was, you know, obviously quite amazing. Phenomenal. Yeah. So there I was on the bed. And at that point, I decided just to roll over onto my knees and my husband got up and I was kind of leaning on him, possibly biting his shoulder a couple of times.
That's great.
That came out of left field, sorry.
I didn't draw blood, okay? So
you were lovingly biting his shoulder or was it just like...
No, it was like mid-contraction.
Vampire
biting. I really just, I feel like biting will help me with the pain and your shoulder is here.
So great. Oh,
love it. So yeah, what happened after the biting episode?
I birthed in that position. I don't know how long that second stage lasted. I'm sorry. I should have asked, but I didn't, because I was like, oh, I'm okay with this birth. If, you know, it felt like an eternity, but, you know, it was also once baby's head was out, it was like the whole baby was out in like half a second. And I will never forget that feeling of baby actually leaving my body, because I mean, words can't really describe it. It was just this miraculous feeling of, wow, he's left my body, but he's still a part of me. And I really feel that now, because I can't explain it. But, and then that, you know, that instant flood of oxytocin as soon as baby's born was also pretty awesome, I'm not going to lie.
How did that feel? Was it quite emotional for you?
It was, it was really elating. It was probably the best I've ever actually felt. And my husband tells the story quite well, I think, because he was, I think he was probably dealing with a lot of his own trauma from the first birth. And so he's sitting there going, oh my God, she's asked for an epidural and we're all ignoring her. She's going to finish this and divorce me. It's over. She hates me. And I think it was maybe a minute after baby was out. And I said, oh, thank you all for not listening when I said I wanted an epidural. And he said, he said he couldn't believe that, you know, I'd gone from this, you know, let's be honest, screaming wild woman biting my shoulder. This, you know, then happy person going, oh, thanks guys, that was really awesome work, everyone. But, you know, then I picked up my baby and cuddled him and, you know, hit him where he was supposed to be and bubble of love.
That's so great. How big was he in the end? So you'd been told he would be big. Was he as big as predicted, or?
So the estimate before I went into labor was that he would be 4.25 kilos, give or take 500 grams. And I went, okay, let's take 500 grams and assume he's going to be 3.75 kilos. He was 4.75 kilos or 10 pound eight.
Wow.
This is amazing. Wow.
And how was your
how did you feel knowing that you'd birthed a baby that was this large?
I felt like Superwoman. I think I texted my close friends later that day and I was like, I just need you to know that I am actually Superwoman, because I just birthed this giant baby who is 10 pound eight.
That's not even the best part, is it, Christy? Because Mel was going to ask you, what's the best part?
Yes, the best part. What were your parts like down there? That's what I was interested in.
So, I had no tearing at all.
Bam. That's amazing.
Incredible.
Unbelievable.
Perineum, just from the way my midwife had coached me through crowning and birthing.
So there was obviously no trauma on your pelvic floor or no coaching of pushing going on there. Do you think it was also because you'd stayed so active and movable throughout this period? Do you think that was helping?
I think that definitely helped get baby kind of at the optimal position, at the optimum angle to kind of get through. But I really feel like the way she really did coach me through the crowning, you know, with the don't push, bite pants, just little push. We communicated and worked together really well. And, you know, it meant that I wasn't pushing baby out too quickly, which, you know, would have torn my perineum.
Wow, that's just an amazing story. Yeah. I'm actually curious to know, did you go talk to Mr. 40%? I would love to know whether you went back and gave any feedback, or if anyone tell you that you had 100% feedback.
Yes, I wish I had. No, I didn't. I was like, oh, maybe he'll look up my notes.
She's better than that. She's above that, Mel. She's Superwoman by now.
I know.
I was going to ask you, did you engage in anything like perennial massage or any of those things that they suggest to avoid tearing? Had you done anything like that?
Yeah, we had done perineal massage. And I found, I don't know if it does anything physically, but it did help me learn to not fight that sensation of having your perineum stretched, because it is a really bizarre, painful, uncomfortable sensation. And I think possibly our body's instinct is to clench against it. So I think for me, the important part of the massage was learning to relax with when you feel that sensation. I don't know. That's how it works for me.
And how consistent were you with that massage?
We did it every day for, I think, a few weeks in the lead up to birth, or if not every day, very close to.
So that could have really been another factor that helped hugely.
Possibly.
Yeah.
And something you didn't do in your first birth? It was something that you learned through your feedback?
We did the massage in my first birth. It's just that baby never actually got up to the perineum in my first birth. So.
Okay, sure.
Who knows what would have happened.
And how big was your first baby?
He was 8 pound 2. So it was a pretty significant jump from baby one to baby two. And I don't think I'll be going back for a third.
Do you think having such an amazing second birth, did that change your mind at all? Did you, you know, obviously in that moment, did you think, wow, I could do that again?
No. Like, if I'm really honest, and everyone says, oh, you get the pain of labor. Like I am very happy with that labor and overall, overwhelmingly positive experience. And I loved the feelings that came when baby was out. But, you know, the labor it was pretty hard work. But I wouldn't be scared to have another one based on the labor, really. I shouldn't say that I wouldn't go back for it, because it wouldn't stop me from having a third.
I forgot to ask you about third stage, your placenta.
Oh, yeah. So there was a bit of bleeding and my midwife couldn't tell where it was coming from. So I did have an injection of Syntocinin to just hurry that along. At this point, I was holding my baby. So I was like, I don't care what you do down there. Whatever. I'm good. So, yeah, that helped the placenta come along. I think it was a little slow, but it was also a pretty big placenta. Like, we didn't weigh it, but I looked at it and I was like, so that's the size of an average baby. Like, you know. And that was fine for me.
And immediately following the birth, how does, obviously, you know, apart from the obvious things, how did you feel compared to your first experience?
Look, honestly, it was really chalk and cheese, and not just for me, but for my baby as well. So I was, you know, in this complete state of just elation and just pure joy, as opposed to shell-shocked trauma the first time around. And I know some of that will just be, I'm a second time mum, so I don't have all that anxiety of not knowing what I'm doing. But also, and I've noticed this, you know, obviously in the 6 months since birth, my baby is so chilled. You know, my first baby was so clingy and needy, and still is really very clingy and needy child, processing his own trauma from that. Whereas, you know, my second baby is like, you know, smiled for the first time at 4 weeks and hasn't stopped smiling since. He's just this most zen chilled baby. And I feel like, A, that's, you know, his personality, but B, he's reflecting back what I'm feeling as a parent this time around.
110%. Yeah, absolutely. Everything you just said actually relates heavily back to my own experience. Yeah, with both of them.
I just wonder how many kids are out there suffering trauma from their birth experiences.
And if they say if the important outcome is to have a healthy baby, well, yes, but
we can do better than that.
And if you have a healthy mother, as you said, that's going to be reflected back in the child and the relationship that you and the bond that you're forming with them. So that's really important.
You know, healthy mother means more than just physically intact, you know.
100%.
Right. Yes.
So how did your breastfeeding journey go this time around?
So my second baby also had a tongue tie, which I felt literally as soon as he latched. I was like, oh, hello, darling, you've got a tongue tie. I knew to expect that because it is genetic. So I was like, had already called the laser clinic and said, we're going to have another baby. So we'll probably be in there within the next few weeks. So, you know, we had the exact same issue again with my milk not coming in and freaking out over that a bit, even though I knew it would come in. But, you know, we did the same thing. We got the tongue tie separated and breastfeeding quite happily now.
Did you have the baby blues this time?
I did. I was a bit surprised, actually, because I was on this just massive high for the 3 days of just like, I am the best person in the world. So, you know, and I was a bit surprised that I then did have them. So I think it just, you know, that you can't really fight those hormones.
Yeah. Was the difference this time that was perhaps the standard baby blues that we talk about having, that's related to the hormone, the natural hormones that occur post-birth?
It wasn't as severe and it definitely wasn't as long.
Did you want to tell us postpartum following this second birth, how were you going and how did this compare to the first time?
So when I went home, I was a little bit surprised that I did enter a state of hypervigilance again, which was similar to the first birth because, you know, trauma like that, unfortunately, as much as we processed it, you know, can come up and bite us at any time. But, you know, I rang my psychologist straight away. She did a couple of home visits and we had some therapy sessions that really helped to just interrupt that cycle and those patterns of thought. And I just feel like I said, we kind of got past that point, obviously a lot earlier this time around. You know, I could leave my baby sleeping in a cot without, you know, checking him every 30 seconds to make sure he was still breathing. You know, I could fall asleep at night because it was okay that my baby was going to wake me up in 30 minutes, you know, that's okay, we can sleep, that's fine, sleep is good, you know. Yeah, the difference in my sleeping and baby sleeping is profound. So it was definitely a lot different this time around, a lot easier to get through emotionally, I would say.
Were you seeing your psychologist during the pregnancy as well?
Yes. The,
like regular sort of catch-ups? Yeah.
About every 3 weeks, yeah.
That's such a great story and an amazing VBAC triumph with a baby that size, I have to say. Just the no tearing just amazes me. It's just incredible.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I would tell people, I had, you know, so I had this baby, he was 10 pound 8, and people would go, oh, cesarean. And I'd go, no. And they'd go, and they'd get this look on their face just, and I can tell, and I'm like, thank you for your concern. My perineum is fine. Now they're like, I want to ask if she's been torn in two, but I also don't. So you just have to go, actually fine. I'm fine.
That's so good. That's so good.
Inspirational story.
But having that continuity of care, the relationship with the midwife at the hospital was obviously a huge difference this time around as well. You had someone that clearly you trusted and you gelled with, as opposed to the first time. It sounded like it was not just a bad fit, but poor practice potentially. So it was great that you were able to unpack everything that went on there and move on in such a positive way. Well done, you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Really,
no, thank you. Thank you. I think it is so important to share these stories. So thank you for providing a platform for that.
Yeah, and I do think it's interesting you say with the PS, you know, the post-traumatic stress that picking that up, you know, a year later. And I think many women may never pick that up. So I think it's important to draw attention to what that looks like post-birth, and the different forms that it can take and the fact that you can get help for it. Some women may feel that they're not able to access these services, but it's good to know that they're out there, and all you need to do is use your agency to go and ask for that help. Yeah. And seek it when you need it. So yeah. I think that's a very good message. So yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for listening to this VBAC story. If you like the show, please subscribe and feel free to leave a review. If you would like to connect with us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for VBAC Birth Stories. If you have a question or you'd like to express interest in sharing your personal story, email us at vbacbirthstories@gmail.com. VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.